You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is David Rhodes. Welcome, David.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
David, it's good to see you this morning. And so we have talked about this show and how we to make it happen. We're going to be playing some music in Hebrew and some music from Israel and some music from around the U.S. and some music from Africa that's local. We've got a lot of stuff going on. But we start the show with, who are you? And that question is, you can take it any way you want, as big or as small, or labels or qualities.
All right. Well, I'm a sibling. I'm the second of five. And so growing up, I definitely saw myself as somewhat of a mediator, trying to resolve conflicts, definitely a part of a lot of the conflicts too, but trying to
You're
play
not
that
oldest.
Role.
Yeah.
Definitely not the oldest. I have an older brother, three younger sisters, and actually my youngest sister, Yael, just moved to town over this past summer. So it's been amazing to have her nearby, and she teaches my two-year-old son 2 days a week. There's a local preschool, Biyachad, Jewish preschool, so she's his teacher, and he absolutely loves school. I mean, he'll run around literally picking out his clothes and helping to make breakfast in his very helpful sort of way, and then I'll run out to the car, really excited to go to school. And that wasn't me. I was definitely running the other way through middle school, running away from the car as best I could.
Right, right.
So I'm a father. I have a 2-year-old Nadav, and almost 11-month-old Anya. And it's fascinating to talk about these questions of identity from the perspective of a parent. Mm-hmm. It's not just who am I, but it's also what role do I want to play as my children figure out and form who they are. And definitely thinking through these questions, I appreciate my own parents thinking through some of these same questions from their perspective. And then my wife, Jenny, is an incredible partner in this journey, constantly like challenging me to think in new ways about things that I've taken for granted and to engage with the depth of life and love. Mm-hmm. So I'm Jewish. I'm also a teacher. I came running back to school. I teach 8th grade social studies at the Alternative School for Math and Science in Corning. And the question of identity is one that I actually raise with my students. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I share. I mean, I tell them about who I am. I share aspects of my heritage, formative experiences. Together we explore these connections between identity and questions of ethics and social justice. So I'm someone, thinking about this question, I'm someone who finds value in that meta-analysis and delving into these questions of ethics and the human experience as they connect to identity, and that's really why I teach.
And it seems like there was something that changed about being in school for you, and we can probably get to that later. Do you want to say anything more before we cut to music?
Just I can talk about what's coming up in
the lyrics.
So this first song is compiled by my sister Tippi, who lives in Chicago, and she took a West African griot melody and lyrics from a Mishnaic text. It's a Mishnaic Hebrew text from the Ethics of Our Fathers. And the lyrics in English.
Can I say one thing about a Mishnaic text?
Yeah.
The Mishnah was a set of writings that codified oral tradition, and they were put together at almost exactly the same time that the Christian Gospels were put together. So the two texts are oftentimes fascinating to read next to each other because they are so incredibly similar, converging on about 90% of what matters in terms of ethics and justice. But it's just an interesting piece, and they came together in similar locations.
Well, yeah, definitely. I'd love to learn more about and kind of experience that and see those connections. And so this particular one is asking a few questions. The first question is, who is rich? Right? And it's the person who's happy with what they have. Next question is, who is wise? It's the person who learns from all others. And then the third stanza is kind of a statement that you're not obligated to finish the task. You don't have to finish the task of really healing the world or, creating a world that is completely just, right? but you can't just let it slide. You've got to give it your all. You've got to put yourself into it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's what the lyrics mean. It's kind of this simple wisdom that really resonates with me. And we sing to our children every day when they're going to sleep as part of their bedtime routine. It's something that shows up in our weekly routines and holidays too.
Who is rich? He who is happy with what he has. Who is wise? He who learns from every person. You are not obligated to finish the task, but neither are you free to give it up. Wow, those are great lines. Okay, we're going to go. And that was Zipporah Rhodes setting an ancient text to an African melody. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is David Rhodes, and that was his sister. Anyway, so David, what is an experience, or what are some of the experiences that have really helped to shape or define who you are?
Well, there's a few that definitely come to mind, and one experience that directly connects to where I see myself going was actually an experience on my honeymoon in Colombia. I was with my wife in Colombia, South America, in a small town called Charalá. And we were teaching English, and a student of mine was also a social studies and philosophy teacher in that town at the high school level. And he actually invited me to come to speak to his class. And as a guest speaker, and he specifically wanted me to come, invited me to speak about the Holocaust and to connect my family history and my life to the presentation and to teaching the context as well. So the experience teaching, you know, I had taught English before, but the experience teaching and thinking through with this teacher, what are our goals here? Mm-hmm. What do we want to really have students engage with and grapple with? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It transformed into a whole sequence, not just an appearance, but a sequence and a collaborative experience that was about anti-bias work and what are we engaging with when it comes to the human response to difference. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so experiencing that process, kind of thinking from the teacher standpoint, being the teacher and then working with him, we continued to work together. And then I eventually started working and visiting a school that was a boarding school on the weekends for people, for students who had to work and help their families during the week, they'd go to a boarding school on the weekends, and they needed somebody just to jump in and teach social studies and philosophy. And so that was a really incredible experience for me that shaped my path, that made me realize at that point, okay, this is where I want to go. And I'm not sure how that's going to manifest down the road, but that was a very, I guess, formative time.
So what about the experience of preparing yourself to meet with these students changed you? What did you have to come to terms with that you had not come to terms with before?
Well, I had definitely learned about the Holocaust, and I'd had these kind of experiences thinking about what is it we need to understand, you know? And one thing I definitely feel as a teacher is that until you have to facilitate a class with students, those questions can kind of continue to just percolate and not necessarily come to a sense of, okay, this is where I see this as being incredibly important, this work. So what that experience really did for me was highlight why grappling with some of these horrific times in history, and it's not specific to the Holocaust, but grappling with these times, what is it we need to understand? Is it like, oh, there were these evil people who we need to watch out for and make sure it doesn't happen again? Watch out for the rise of neo-Nazi or Nazi party? Or is it about something that has to do with something that's inside all of us? And once it became a question of what is this human, I guess, tendency, or what is this human capacity?
Or that propensity was the word that came to mind when you were speaking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, where does it come from? And what do we need to understand about it as people? And what questions do we need to explore together, as opposed to me being on the stage saying, hey, I've got the answers.
Right.
So those were the sorts of questions. And then for me, that process, that it really just clarified.
Right.
In that sort of way.
Right. When I think about you teaching in Colombia, I was an exchange student in Colombia in Pereira. And I don't know where the city, the village, those that you were in. But when I was there in 1976, the family that I stayed with managed to be clear of the La Violencia, which was the political battles that would send that took place in the 50s and 60s, late 40s, and it was the first extended civil war in after World War II in a Latin American country, I think. And my friends, my girlfriend's family at the time, was whenever the liberals were in power, they were down in their house. But when the conservatives came in power, they had to go up in the mountains and eat potatoes and basically live off the land, because there was this violence. It was a part of the culture. And later the violence morphed into drug related violence, but it wasn't the same. And I'm wondering, did you have a chance to explore with those kids their family histories of violence, whether it was the drug-related violence or as part of your Holocaust exploration?
Definitely. It came up. I saw a movie that, a documentary connected, and actually a movie called Colores de la Montaña, that Colors of the Mountains, that really explore the history from perspective of young people, and then asking some of the kind of community members, and then engaging with those questions with the community members, was definitely something that was very present, and really teaching. That's why teaching about the Holocaust turned into something else. It was like, okay, what are these same exact things that we're seeing here? What are these same messages about how people, that propensity to respond in different ways, and it's to respond as to borrow from an organization called Facing History that I really regard incredibly highly when it comes to the teaching about these questions. I mean, the propensity to be either an upstander, to stand up, or to be a bystander and just see what's happening and not engage, or to be a perpetrator. What is it that we're talking about? And then those same exact questions would apply. And what was interesting in teaching younger people, the high school students, was that I think in their lived experience, it was talking about the past. When we went into questions of their present, And either power structures that existed in a specific school, I remember, came up with one group. You know, how do we engage with this issue that keeps coming up? There was a teacher who the students felt was really, in a sense, abusing power. Mm-hmm. And where does that come from? And what do you do to engage with that? Or gender roles, mm-hmm. you know, stereotypes around different questions, homosexuality, all of these questions. Once we kind of created the space to engage in these difficult conversations, came out from that same starting point. Mm-hmm. So I think for the students I was working with, it wasn't so much connected directly to their lived experience with the violence mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. Colombia, but much more kind of reflecting on some of those same concepts and then going into the, okay, so how does this apply to your life? And then from there, and this is what really speaks to me as a teacher, mm-hmm. is a sequence of, okay, so what is the human response to difference? What are we learning in these specific historical contexts, recent history, earlier history? So what? What do we need to understand for ourselves about what our own choices mm-hmm. Can impact in the world around us and what roles we play in terms of can be privilege, oppression, social justice? How are we playing a role? And then now what? Mm-hmm. Right? To really bring it to that point of, so what do we do? You know, we can learn in a way that can almost be depressing, like, wow, this is a horrible world that we live in. This is right. horrible that humans have this propensity, this capacity to do these things, and to just leave feeling almost disempowered. Mm-hmm. And for mm-hmm. me, the goal of teaching is to empower.
Right. Okay. So from what I'm hearing is that to do that, you have to face, I mean, what I'm going to say, the way that I try to dance on that issue is, we live with conflict. We're not going to resolve them. We can, if we let them go so far that we annihilate each other, then everybody loses. But we are not going to paper them over or make them go away. So how do we live with conflict? And how do you, I mean, because that to me seems to be the moral agenda for this era, because we have thousands of different identities and different ways of life and different values, and we're never going to reconcile them. So how do you approach that?
So it comes right back to that first question, the question of identity, because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when we kind of create the space to have these conversations, come up with a contract and really get student input, then a question of identity, you look around the room, you see how people are sharing their different backgrounds. It can be a student mm-hmm. from Pakistan who's lived in five different places, speaks multiple languages. You have a student who was born and raised in Corning and has an experience of truly just being immersed and living in the same home their whole mm-hmm. lives and mm-hmm. what insight they bring. And then the different religions represented in the room, the different backgrounds, interests, hobbies, heritage. And then when you look around the room, you're like, okay, wow. In whatever room, you know, there's mm-hmm, mm-hmm. there are differences. And then that question of how should people respond to difference? And what's come up in conversation has been people throw around ideas, and then we really kind of dissect them, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. celebrate differences, appreciate differences, respect differences, tolerate differences. And then there's always a question that has come up, which is, okay, what are the limits of tolerance? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And through that process, we then go into, from how should people respond to how do people respond? What is really mm-hmm. Happening in situations of conflict, and why? How do we understand the motivations, the perspectives? Not necessarily especially in certain situations, not to justify unconscionable acts,
right.
but to understand and then figure out a constructive way to engage and move forward. So it's exactly that. It's living in these times of conflict and thinking together, what are our values? What are our values? Where do they conflict with the structures in the world around us? Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do about it? How are we going to bring people into that conversation?
Right, right. And I guess because I'm going to press a little bit here. One of the statements in the Christian Gospels is that steel sharpens steel, and that in the conflict we become clearer about what it is we value without having to resolve the conflict. And so there's a keeping each other honest, even though we don't necessarily have to agree. But this is a very hard concept for adults to get their heads around. And I was just reading something this morning in the New York Times where it's very hard for college students. So I'm wondering, do you even get there with eighth graders?
Absolutely. And the sure. way it gets there is there are two different conversations about values. One, I think, has to do with comprehensive beliefs about the world. And you can tell a whole story. I can tell my whole story about my own values, my own, I mean, it can be religious, ethical.
Sure.
You know? So then when you're interacting with somebody else who has maybe a completely different comprehensive set of values, what I find is the true challenge and the most rewarding process is to find the common values, those shared principles that may not lead to comprehensive agreements or comprehend. You know, it's one of the things that comes up when we kind of create a space to have these conversations in a classroom is that, you know, we're gonna have to accept and actually expect non-closure.
Right.
You know, the point is not to leave this room altogether. But if we can find those common values and think, okay, we do share these fundamental principles, however broader they may be, where can we move forward together?
Right. I guess, but the image that's coming to my mind, and what I'm going to play with you a little bit here, is we can never reduce our relationship to what we have in common. Because that's like, you know, trying to live just a portion of the Venn diagram of our life, whereas we live to the edges. And so how we can appreciate that somebody needs to do something that's out of bounds for us, but it's in bounds for them. And that's a really tough place to go. But if you've listened closely to the story, as you're saying, then you can appreciate their story and their need to do it, even if you could never do it. Am I making sense? Or even if you could never justify it. But you somehow can accept it. There are things that go beyond our ability to tolerate, as you had alluded to. But I'm trying to stay really closely to the place where the rubber hits the road, which is when we not only allow but we and not bless, because you can't really bless somebody that you fundamentally disagree with, in honesty. You know what I mean? But you can wonder at them. You can have an experience of awe and fear for them. Am I making sense? And that's that indeterminate. There's no closure there.
There isn't closure. And I think what does come through the process that I'm at my most fundamental level kind of interested in is one that says, okay, there are red lines, and the way to define those red lines in any human interaction is to figure out, okay, where are the as broad as we need to get those points of common ground. And you're right, we're never going to get to a point that we don't live in that space, right?
Right.
What you do when you get to that space is recognize, okay, there are some sorts of actions.
It's pretty safe to move in that space.
It's safe to move in that space, and it's really important to see from my perspective that it's not a question of compromising values.
Right.
But what it does is say, okay, can we agree? For example, I mean, this is going right into something that'll maybe come up later.
Sure.
But in the context of like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, certain principles that come to mind connected to ethics in war, and really this whole approach is based on this guy named Rawls, who's a philosopher who really paints a picture of this process of it's not about putting yourself necessarily in someone else's shoes, but about trying to take off all the shoes and then imagine you don't know which shoes you're going to get. What are you left with? And in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example, you have, let's say, basic principles like civilians shouldn't be deliberately targeted, or civilian life should be treated with equal respect. If you're planning or executing some kind of action or policy, civilian life should be treated with equal respect regardless of religion, nationality.
Which side of the issue you're on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then to move forward from there, say, okay, what is going on right now on the ground, concrete, that from this kind of shared space, because there are people who will not agree to those two principles.
Right, yes.
But if you can unite the people who do, you know, and if you can figure out, okay, so then these sorts of actions are unconscionable, where do we move forward? How do we create a more just world?
Right. And what I'm thinking, because I'm going to play with this example, so I'm taking your advice, and what I'm saying is that between the Israelis and the Palestinians, we communicate with each other about the people who cannot be trusted to honor civilians on either side. And we make their names known, and we make their situations known, so they cannot operate in ways that are terroristic on anybody. So that having that common ground means you don't necessarily Aiden Abet the enemy, but you have decided that the certain things are beyond the red lines, which is a very powerful statement. And it's a way of, we can do it when we talk to each other. But if we don't know how to communicate with each other, we can't get there.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like that sort of constructive dialogue is not about normalizing a status quo or
it's about normalizing talking about value.
Talking about value. And then what it creates the potential for is a breakdown of dichotomy. You know, sometimes you have a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. Are you pro-Israeli? Are you pro-Palestinian? And for me, it's what does it mean to actually break that down and be pro-solution and bridge the really rights-respecting, reasonable people who want to come together and to engage. And this is something that I feel I've learned through experience and I am still learning, is how to engage with the emotional, psychological elements. You know, I can mm-hmm. I can talk about these principles till I'm blue in the face.
Right.
But unless someone feels like what they're saying matters and that they're feeling heard and being heard.
And they can see it. To me, you have to add another piece there. Physical response. Mm-hmm. I have a sense that I am being heard when I see physical changes in your face and in your body to what I say. I know that what my message has landed as I intended when the nonverbals show that it has arrived. And then the same way back and forth. So it's intellect, it's emotion, and it's body, mm-hmm. physicality. And we very rarely take the time to look that closely at each other, but it's the same quality as listening mm-hmm. that closely.
And
to each other.
Absolutely. And I think it's taking the time to listen closely and then to reflect. You know, when I describe my identity, questions of, okay, straight, white, male, mm-hmm. where do these things connect mm-hmm. In my experience? Where do my biases come from mm-hmm. and how are mm-hmm. they going to impact the way I relate to others? How do others perceive me and how might that impact the way I interact? How does that connect to opportunities or expectations? Mm-hmm. And once it goes there to that space of I need to engage in this communication and this reflective mm-hmm. process, mm-hmm. then when I have some kind of gut or knee-jerk reaction, that's my initial reaction that we all have, human right. beings.
Nothing, we don't perceive anything without a reaction.
But to have the ability yeah. to stop and think, okay, I'm having this reaction, where do I go with this? Mm-hmm. What do I need to do yeah. in order to process this in an ethical way or in a way that I can question the assumptions that are coming into play here before taking action?
Right.
And have that
right.
inform
how can
my
I
action.
Really understand it? How can I really understand what's going on with me before I do something
exactly.
this reactive as opposed to intentional?
So it's understanding the perspectives around and understanding the biases and perspectives within those. Some of those. Mm-hmm. It can be implicit biases. We see that in this country. And this is, I think, different. I want just drawing a very clear distinction, I think, in this country when we talk about structural racism, mm-hmm. as opposed to something like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, when I think it's very complex and there's a really unconscionable acts being perpetrated by people, groups on both sides. When you have structural racism, you're talking about a situation of absolute oppressor and oppressed in a certain sense. You're talking about the structure of society.
Complete assumptions of what's right and wrong that are privileged in specific ways.
Yeah, and a system that's set up that, okay, how do we combat this system is another question that I feel very called to try to figure out what my role is mm-hmm. And how does that play out in my choices as a person, as a in different roles as a teacher.
Right, right. Let's we'll pick that up in a minute. Let's cut mm-hmm. to some music. What music would you like for us to go to at this point? There's the Unit piece and there's the why am I blanking?
Let's do the you know what? We have Hadag Nachash. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to get to the Unit piece as well.
Sure.
So maybe we'll start with Hadag Nachash okay. and then it transitions into
okay.
Unit.
Okay. So maybe we'll do part of each of them and then you can explain. I'm assuming that they're both in Hebrew.
No, Unit's actually a local musician and it's in
oh.
English.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Hadag Nachash is in Hebrew.
Yeah, okay, very good.
The
very
bumper
good.
Sticker song.
Yes, okay, we got it.
Shalom. תנו לצהל לנצח עם חזק עושה שלום תנו לצהל לקסח אין שלום עם ערבים אל תתנו להם רובים חמי זה אחי אחי גיוס לכולם תור לכולם שום ייאוש בעולם יש הזה כאן הנחמן מאומן no fear משיח בעיר אין ערבים אין פיגועים בגץ מסכן ילדים העם עם הגולן העם עם התוצר חבר אתה חסר הקדוש ברוך הוא אנחנו בוחרים בך בחירה ישירה זרה הקדוש ברוך הוא אנחנו קנאים לך
ימותו הקנאים
כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם קוראים לי נחמן ואני מגם מגם גיים כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם ברוך השם אני נושם ולחם מדינת הלכה הלכה המדינה משנולד הרוויח יחי המלך המשיח יש לי ביטחון בשלום של שרון חברון מאז ולתמיד ומי שלא נולד יציב חברון אבות שלום תצבר כאן הצדק
סיינן משקר
צריך מנהיג חזק
סכן על השלום תודה על הביטחון
אין לנו ילדים למלחמות מיותרות השמאל עוזר לערבים וטוב ליהודים פושעי אוסלו לדין אנחנו כאן הם שם אחים לא מבקרים עקירת יישובים מפלגת את העם מוות לבוגרים תנו לחיות
And I'm going to let this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is David Rhodes, and I'm going to let him introduce the title and the author of that song because I'm not good in Hebrew, so I'm not knowing exactly how to do this. So.
Okay, well, it's called Hadag Nachash is the name of the group,
uh-huh.
And it's Shirat HaSticker. It's the bumper sticker song, and really all of the lyrics in that song are. Bumper stickers you would actually see in Israel. So for me, this song conveys something that is about media.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, media are all around us. And it's something that we were just talking about, the idea that sometimes it can be simplified in a certain way. The world can be broken down into dichotomies and into slogans and sound bites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And bumper stickers.
And bumper stickers. And it's the perfect, you see them and then everyone sees them and then it can feel really almost something that it feels secure. Yes, this is where I'm at and I'm on this side mm-hmm. of it and you're on that side mm-hmm. of it. What's interesting about this song and actually the video that goes with it is that it really shows some of the contradictions and highlights like, okay, these are the kinds of statements and these are the kinds of things that we see all around us. And for me that it gets at something that we all need to be able to do, mm-hmm. which is filter, which is think about it and see the complexity or think about where is this message coming from?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What are the embedded values?
Right.
Who's the target audience? Who does it benefit? Who does it
mm-hmm.
harm?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is it trying to get me to do? And to really engage in that level,
right.
With what we might, I think, as human beings, find this security and okay, I want to just simplify, and then I can take action. And you know what? I can get other people to take action too, because it's really easy to paint one side as monstrous and then mm-hmm. say, okay, mm-hmm. now we have this urgency to fight the monster versus engage with the nuance and complexity and say, we need to figure out the constructive way forward.
Right. Right. In the mid 1970s in this country, there was what I think is my favorite bumper sticker of all time, which was make love, not war, but be prepared for both. And that kind of sitting in the middle of it in the late 1970s was forcing us to face some of our militaristic past and present, as well as the sexual revolution of the 60s, and not really coming down on anything specific, but holding a lens up to look at both sets of issues, mm-hmm. and that you know we very rarely see bumper stickers that kind of push that on us.
Exactly, yeah. And some do that. They stop and make you think, and sometimes right. you hear a really short statement or a quote that speaks volumes.
Right, right. You don't have to believe what you think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what I mean? So that's yeah, it's yeah, lots of stuff. So you had, you wanted to tie this into the next song with a local musician.
Yeah. So, so do you want to jump right in? Do you want me to
go do the transition? Yeah.
Okay. So, there's one tie-in is I just, heard her play live at Grassroots and with my family, we had a blast, just this, amazing experience together, with the music. And I love this song. It's called When Reason Meets Resistance. And again, it kind of ties into what we were talking about when it comes to having conversations that, if you focus only on reason and not that emotional piece, not the psychology behind it, the lived experiences, the trauma, the, those really, really messy human lives that are impacted. That understanding is something I need to continue to develop. I'm not there. And I really, for me, thinking about my role in the constructive way forward in any conflict, but right now thinking in this context, thinking in the context as a teacher, what do I need to understand and how can I develop that understanding? And then the other aspect of it, when reason meets resistance, is that sometimes in my own head, you know, there are limits to metacognition. You can keep going back and back, or this infinite regress. And why do I think, what am I thinking?
Yeah.
And then to figure out, okay, at a certain point, there is a sense of mystery of, okay, what is it that we're, what is the motivation? Once you get to that point of value, where do the values come from? Right. And reaching that point and then kind of embracing some of that mystery. So there's so many elements of that line. And I don't know the full context of the song from the songwriter's perspective, from Yanit's perspective, but this is what it means to me.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful.
Distance, hours mean resistance. I'm so in my
And that was Unit and Reason Meets Resistance. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is David Rhodes. So David, you know, it's really hard, I think, for people to learn that I can laugh with you, I can cry with you, and in the moment, I'm there with you 100%, but we may not have to agree about much except that moment. And to honor that and to live in the mystery of it is a tough place. I think we've been dancing around those kinds of images all morning, emotionally and rhetorically. You wanted to talk about a Holocaust letter, and can you frame that and then read it with us?
Sure. I mean, it's a letter from a principal to teachers on the first day of school, and what it does and why I want to read it is that I think it conveys something that is about teaching in any context and is about what we as people need to understand. And it really ties in directly to some of the work that I'm doing, not just in the classroom, but creating a speaker network for educators, for people to hear local stories, people who have a lived experience that gives them an insight into some of those human propensities we're talking about, to stand up or to be perpetrators or to be bystanders. And to
sometimes a defender and a perpetrator are the same thing. I mean, living in that complexity where we're doing good and evil all at the same time.
Yeah, definitely engaging with some of those questions. And you can see real change and transformation happen within a person over time in specific moments. And to really think about it in those sorts of terms. Mm-hmm. So this letter, I think, tries to bring it there. So just jump right in.
Sure.
Read it. So it's, "Dear teacher, I am a survivor of a concentration camp. My eyes saw what no man should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers, children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot and burned by high school and college graduates. So I am suspicious of education. My request is, help your students become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, arithmetic are important only if they serve to make our children more humane."
So how do you take that into your teaching?
Well, for me, it leaves the question, how do you teach someone to be more humane? And for me, that was a question that led to many different answers, but they all had something in common, which had to do with hearing stories and hearing that kind of inner monologue and hearing from people who not only can speak in terms of, you know, I often go towards theory, but it can speak in terms of their lived experience and that experience in the context of a speaker network we're creating, or I'm actually on a Holocaust education committee in Corning and one in Ithaca, where we bring in speakers annually for a lecture and connect to education and to teachers in classrooms, who can speak to that experience of being seen as other or that understanding of, okay, what can I learn about people and what from my lived experience do I think I can share about my hope or my call to action and to learning. So for me, that this led to a question of who do I need to bring in? What stories, what perspectives do I need to bring in to my classroom? Not necessarily me saying, here's the answer to the students. I actually try to refrain from doing that. But really me bringing in voices to then explore with the students and to engage in that process of what's happening here. What is this person sharing? So some of the people in our network, we've done interviews with a man who grew up, he was born in Geneva actually, and then grew up living north and spending most of his time actually in the South in Alabama during the Jim Crow era. And he was one of the first black students in his desegregated high school. And then his stories, and his lived experience through to the present, talking about race and racism, North and South, then and now, what are the realities today that we really need to confront and talk about, and not just talk about, but then figure out the way forward together. Incredibly powerful. We just recently did an interview with Roald Hoffman, who is a Holocaust survivor. I mean, he's known oftentimes as a member of the faculty at Cornell, and he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and he...
And he's been on this show.
And he's been on this show. Okay. So his lived experience and his insight, I feel that I've had the opportunity to speak with him is an honor, and has kind of helped me along a path. You know, same thing for David Rowe, the first speaker I mentioned. It's a transformative experience for me to hear these speakers, and I just want to share that experience to then create the context and then hear the speakers in a safe space for the speaker and the students, and then to debrief together and ask questions and explore and see where it takes us.
And I guess for me, the critical piece, and you highlighted it before, was how do we become more humane? Because that isn't a challenge unless you assume that we are fully capable, each and every one of us, at any time of being inhumane, of being evil or mean or cruel. And how do we become more humane means accepting some of that stuff up front. How do you get to that precondition with teenagers or with, eighth graders, to that awareness that we're inhumane, and then how could we be more humane?
You know, I think it's by doing two things at the same time. It's not just that we are inhumane, we need to be more humane. It's that we all have the capacity to be inhumane or humane, and we all can engage in that way.
At the same time.
Yeah, so exactly. We have that within us as people. So one way, and this is kind of a concrete way of articulating the question, is to ask students, as we watch and we learn about, let's say there's an experiment called the third wave, where this guy Ron Jones, teacher in California, essentially turns his class into an autocracy. And step by step, you know, and then he pulls back the curtain at the end, and students watching this, and there's a documentary actually on YouTube called The Lesson Plan that has students reflecting and him reflecting on it. And there's also a movie, and I actually particularly go for the movie in German that was made, I think, in 2008, about this experiment. And there's other experiments. What happens, and by the end, is that so many of the students are so drawn in that he himself, the teacher, Ron Jones, is wondering, how far can I take this? And with the span of a week, it's incredibly disturbing to see how far it goes. And in the story of what happened, at the end he says, you're now going to meet your leader. This is not just a classroom. This is actually a national movement. Come meet your leader. And this room fills up. And throughout the week, there are these different aspects of exclusion happening and harassment and bodyguards and kind of the supremacist ideology forming. And then there's nobody shows up, and everyone starts to wonder, what's going on here? And it's kind of this ingrained, like, blind obedience. What's happening here? What is that? And then eventually there's a screen that comes on. It's all static, and then Hitler comes on the screen. And this is what happened in California. I show the German movie to then ask, is this specific to Germany? And then we go into, okay, where does this come from? And there's also, there's the Jane Elliott, someone who I really admire, and she does the blue-eyed and brown-eyed experiment she started with third graders. She does it with adults. She does it with people who work in prison, and she does it with people from all backgrounds all over the world. And again, you see within the span of a day with third graders, you see friends turning each other because she's telling them that blue eyes are better than brown eyes. The next day she flips it and brown eyes are better than blue eyes. And you see within the span of a day what happens to these students. So when we debrief that together, it gets at exactly your question of what's going on here? What do we need to understand about this? Right.
And we need to be suspicious of our minds, suspicious of our emotions, and suspicious of our physical reactions. Doesn't mean that we don't honor them, but we just need to hold them
to think about them
gently.
We need to think about them.
Yeah. So I want to shift gears here a little bit. I like one of the things I like to ask guests near the end of the show is, what do you do to sustain yourself? And what do you do physically, emotionally, mentally to restore yourself when life gets you down or when things are falling apart, on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, yearly? What do you do to kind of restore your sense of balance or your sense of strength to face the day?
I mean, there are a few things that are very relevant right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mentioned actually being at the Grassroots Festival and music with family, really being in that moment. Sometimes mm-hmm. that can be incredibly powerful and just hopeful, inspiring experience. And that was actually what we had specifically hearing you need play. Mm-hmm. We just got back from a 3-day canoe trip. So being outdoors, and that was actually just me and my wife, Jenny, and two friends. And it was just, you're on the river. Everything is, you're completely disconnected. Phone, email, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to-do lists. Soon, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to a place that I've been going to since I was born and since my father was born, going back. It was actually my great-grandfather generation. A place in the Catskills where the extended family comes together. Mm-hmm. And growing up, it was the country. There was the city life, and then there was the country life. And in the country, it was just this freedom and this existence that was about just coming together and living in those moments and having experiences together and building relationships with people in my, like, second, third cousins, you know, that mm-hmm, we'd mm-hmm. see each other, first cousins and my siblings. And now what I want going forward for future generations to create that experience. Another thing, just very in the kind of in keeping with a lot of what I've been talking about here, it is something that gives me hope and helps me in those moments is, talking to people, my wife in particular, talking through what's going on and then hearing from people who are engaged in this work. I mean, when I hear the stories of the people who are going to be in the speaker network, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When I hear from different organizations doing incredibly inspirational work, I mean, I'm on the board of the Center for Transformative Action, mm-hmm. which is kind of an umbrella organization for a lot of nonprofits that are really engaged in transformative action, their social justice oriented work that are that for me to be surrounded and immersed and having those conversations mm-hmm. with people is truly energizing and inspiring. Mm-hmm.
And what's striking to me is that you talked earlier about your tendency to intellectualize or theorize, but all of your restorative activities have a physical, aural, you know, listening music, being on the water, you know, they have this engaged physical quality to them, which is in the experiencing stories as their physical, emotional impact on you. And I'm wondering, what do you do to restart your mind intellectually? Or is that just such a presumed part of your daily work?
It's interesting. I feel like it is kind of, it's my home base. I think that's where I operate automatically.
Right.
So for me, the question is actually how to, and this is for me personally, mm-hmm. is how to sometimes take a pause.
Right.
So then coming back to it, and actually I see them as very connected, you know, to find mm-hmm. this place of peace and hope, it then informs, okay, what helps me get there? What do I see from other people that helps them get there? How can I then be this kind of, I actually heard the term recently from John Forrester, who's mm-hmm. an amazing guy, teaches urban planning and conflict resolution at Cornell, and facilitative leadership. It's what I want to be. It's something that I'm working on becoming. Once I find those places for myself, how do I then bring others into conversation with each other? Not like, here's the answer, but how do I facilitate right. a process or be a part of a process myself that helps others get to that get right. place, myself included?
Right. Right. And the more you trust that the process can be dynamic, joyful, sorrowful, painful, hurtful, and all of those things, then the easier it becomes to facilitate it. You know, but our minds want to hold it in a specific way sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful.
Absolutely.
So, David, it's been really good to get to know you. We could talk for hours and hours and hours, and I look forward to those conversations off air at some point. Thank you.
You
wanted to play a song by Sammy Tay to close with, and I wondered if you could say something about that song.
Yeah, so this is the first song on the Kambu Angels album. It's called Tokido. and Samite, he's from Uganda. He's a local musician, lives and I think performs around the world. And in this particular song, he describes as having a transformative impact on the people listening that he's seen when he's played it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's played here, right in town. He's played in Uganda and Rwanda. He's played for people of all ages. Mm-hmm. Does a lot of work with young people. And it's inspirational. And what he describes in the song is actually that transformative process. What I've come to understand as transformative is getting not just the theory and the understanding, but an actual visceral experience of being in that space of seeing the people around, kind of transcending the differences. Not to say those differences, I think we need to appreciate, celebrate differences, mm-hmm. but to also come together and in a shared experience of music in this context, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In this shared, just joyful, hopeful experience. And then what Samite asks is, how do we extend that experience? The more we can extend that, the better off we'll be, the better this world will be. So I feel like that's what this song represents. And just hearing the music too, for me, it almost makes you want to be involved in it. Hearing it, hearing the rhythms, the melodies, it just kind of brings you into that experience.
And we're going to cut to it. It's Samite and it's Tokido or Tokido?
Tokido. 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 I'm 100% sure of it.
Tokido, kutunundu, kutungunungunu. Kutunundu, Tokido, Kutunundu, Kutungunungunu, 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 Kutunundu,
Teddy Vampire, Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Teddy Vampire,
Kutunundu, Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Teddy Vampire,
Kutunundu, Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Teddy Vampire,
Kutunundu, Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu, Kutunundu, Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu, Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,
Kutunundu,